Email todaysor@rte.ie.
We think of food primarily as food for the body, but the brain too needs nourishment, and from birth to death, what we eat and drink has a vital role in the development and maintenance of our grey matter. That's according to Professor Mike Gibney from the UCD Institute of Food and Health, who's with me in studio. Mike, thanks again for coming in. Eating well, you say, important from cradle to grave. Now, we'll come back to the needs of older people, but even if we start with the baby in the womb, the brain there needs nourishment.
Yeah, it's critically important that the brain is properly nourished in the womb. If it's not, and in the first 2 years of life, then the person is permanently cognitively impaired. In other words, their capacity to do hard work or more sophisticated work is just non-existent for the rest of their lives. They will be slow learners and slow performers.
Well, first of all, what do pregnant women or would-be pregnant women need to do?
Well, the first thing they'd want to do is try and eat as healthier diet as possible, but even a healthy diet will not necessarily provide all of the nutrients they'll need. We know, for example, that just eating an ordinary healthy diet, which excludes vitamin supplements, which excludes fortified foods, women will not get enough folic acid to help the formation of what's called the neural tube. Now, the neural tube goes on to be the spinal column, and it happens in the first 4 weeks of pregnancy. Most women don't even know they're pregnant at that stage. So it's very important that we look after the folic acid side of things. The second thing is iodine. Iodine's getting a lot of attention now because we realise, from what we have known for a long time, that iodine deficiency in pregnancy leads to permanent severe brain damage if the iodine is bad enough. And the term cretinism is associated with iodine deficiency.
How can this be judged or assessed, and how can women know whether they're getting what they need?
Well, they don't. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, one of the main sources of iodine at the moment is milk. But the levels in iodine of milk are falling because farmers used to clean the byres and cows using a thing called iodophore, in other words, a salt containing iodine. That's dying out now. And so the levels of iodine in milk are falling. And so countries like, for example, the UK are approaching the point where they're ranked as being iodine risk. And Ireland will certainly follow suit in due course. And we have studies underway at the moment to find that out. But they won't know in the case of iodine, that in the case of pleural tube defects, they'll know at birth they've had a problem. In the case of iodine, they'll know at 6 or 7 years of age they've had a problem. So it's too late in both cases.
Too late then. Is there any public policy that should be taken or put into place to avert that?
Well, the Food Safety Authority of Ireland have a policy with regard to folic acid and mothers, and they monitor this all the time. And they're reasonably happy that our policy of liberal fortification of foods is enough to solve the problem. In the United States, flour is fortified with folic acid by law. You have no choice. It's there. But it is under scrutiny by the Food Safety Authority on a regular basis. There is now an emerging interest in a number of agencies in Ireland on the issue of iodine, and I expect studies will come out this year saying what the situation is and where we lie, and hopefully action can be taken on that basis.
Now, again, staying with the topic of the baby's brain and why it needs so much energy, I mean, why does it and how can it be transmitted?
Well, a baby, when it's born, needs about 75% of its calories to go up to its brain. Now, if you think of a foal born in Arabia and a foal born in Connemara, they both get up and they run with the herd within 20 minutes to half an hour because they don't need to learn anything. They just want, they're wired to be a horse. But a baby born in a foreign, you know, babies born all over the world need to learn different languages, different cultures, different religions, different musics, different alphabets and everything else. So the brain has to be soft-wired. All the wiring is there, but to connect all the wires to make it a baby of Arabia or a baby of Connemara, that requires the first 2 years of life. And the brain consumes 75% of calories. It's a supercomputer. So 75% of calories go upstairs for a young baby. It falls to about 40% by about 4 years of age. And for us, it's about 25 to 30%. So it's an extraordinary amount your brain uses as much energy a day as you would do if you walked for about an hour and a half a day. So it's a big organ.
And as you say, in the early months and years, it's even a higher proportion.
It's a very
used
high
up by the baby.
Yeah.
Sorry, there was one point I think you might have wanted to make about foods that are a source of iodine, pending other measures being advised by government.
Well, Milk has been the traditionally important source of iodine. That's beginning to die down. Fish and shellfish would be important sources of iodine as well. But we're not a great fish-eating country, unfortunately.
Eggs?
You have me there now. I don't carry these things around in the
okay,
old head,
fine.
I'm afraid.
Well, look, there's another point, which is interesting. The value of food in warding off tiredness.
Yeah. This is beginning to attract a lot of attention between psychologists and nutritionists. And there was a guy, Kahneman, who the Nobel Prize economist, who wrote a book on fast and slow decisions. He cited an example of a paper published in a really prestigious journal where they studied parole judges in Israel. Now, they get 10 minutes to listen to a prisoner who wants to be paroled, and the default is no. So, and it's very intensive arguments that are made on both sides, for and against parole. And what they found was that as it came towards 11 o'clock in the morning, there began to get a smaller number of positives, paroles. As you went towards dinner, it dropped to almost zero. And after dinner, it soared up to 60% were now beginning to get paroled. And they've begun to do experiments with people where they stress them in advance, and then they leave another group listening to music. And then they put both these groups onto sort of studying, solving problems. The group that have received lemonade of either of the two, they're the group that last longer in terms of trying. They don't always succeed in solving it, but they keep trying. The group that don't get the lemonade, who are already fatigued, they just give up.
You're basically making an argument there, Mike, are you not, for snacking?
Oh, I mean, snacking is an important part of human nutrition. It always has been. I mean, young kids can't get enough calories in their day for three meals a day. They have to snack. And adults have traditionally snacked at break time and at 3 o'clock. And that's not for no reason they've done that.
Yeah, but there may be a difference between having a slice of cake or a chocolate cookie as opposed to, say, a half a carrot or a full carrot.
Well, the brain is an obligate user of glucose. It only uses glucose. Now, if your life is threatened, it will begin to use other things. But on a day-to-day basis, it will say, no, thank you. I only want glucose. So the best foods for keeping your brain going are those that will release glucose into the brain. Now, ideally speaking, there are plenty of healthy options you can take here. You don't have to have soft drink beverages all the time. You don't have to have that. A cup of tea with a bit of sugar in it, a slice of cake. I don't know. The dietitians will tell us what's fine. But basically speaking, snacking is an essential part of the working day.
Well, now, I can imagine people being horrified listening to us saying, OK, it's all very well talking about looking after the brain, but what about the waistline and all the consequent things that can happen, heart damage and stress and overweight and all the rest of it?
Well, again, I would say that the waistline is a function of both physical activity and diet, and you cannot ignore the both. If you engage in physical activity, everybody knows you feel better. It does your brain a power of good. It helps unravel wires and whatever. It works almost the same as sleep. It helps you relax. It helps you come to terms with things, and it makes you feel a better person. And that helps your brain and your waistline. So,
now, again, and moving on to people's later years, what importance does our diet take on in regard to preserving the basic functions of the brain? That would be a concern to people who would be, you know, fearful of maybe ending up with dementia or Alzheimer's, whatever.
Well, one area, I mean, there are two areas. One is vision and one is cognitive function. And the most common cause of loss of vision in older people is a thing called age-related macular degeneration. The macula is the spot on the back of the eye. It's often called the eye's nature's Ray-Bans because it filters out certain lights. If that is damaged, a person begins to lose central vision. In other words, they could see this room, but I wouldn't be able to see you, Sean, or I'd see an outline of you. And the National Eye Institute in the US has carried out studies over many years and done intervention studies, and they have shown that certain nutrients can help reduce the risk by about 25% of visual impairment. You then move on to the question of Alzheimer's. One case of Alzheimer's diagnosed globally per second on a 24-hour clock. And we are transitioning from what was a largely young population with a small number of older people to what is largely an older population with a small number of younger people. And most of those old people will be in China and India and South Asia. And it's a huge problem. Now, there is a big interest in studying diet and Alzheimer's, and there is a big literature on it, but it is disappointing. There is, if you look at people with Alzheimer's and people without Alzheimer's, or rather people with cognitive impairment and without cognitive impairment, you will be able to see, for example, that the type of fats you find in salmon and trout, long-chain omega fats, that they're lower in the people with impaired cognitive function. So you might say, well, they're eating less fish. But you could also say, well, they're eating the same amount of fish, but for some reason, they're using it up differently. So when you do the intervention studies, where you actually take people with cognitive impairment or no cognitive impairment and you feed them over years and you see who develops cognitive impairment, you don't find an effect. And there's a strong genetic dimension to Alzheimer's. And probably what we need to do is to find out what is the basis which links the nutrient intake with the genetic disposition. And that will be the group where nutrition will probably work. But we're not there yet, I'm afraid.
So you're not really in a position to say that if you want to lessen your chances of acquiring this condition, you know, take more zinc or copper or vitamin
no,
C. You just can't make those connections.
No.
And with regard to the eye condition?
The eye condition, it's a cocktail now. It's a very specific cocktail which the National Eye Institute have, and people can Google it and get it. And it involves, I think, zinc, vitamin C, and a couple of pigments from coloured vegetables and fruits, like green fruits, yellow fruits, red fruits, and so forth. And that cocktail helps to reduce it. But it's not widely pushed here in Europe, big in the States.
Fascinating stuff. Much to think about there. Mike Gibney, Professor of Food and Health at UCD, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.